Welcome everyone to this week's weekly market update, September 4th, about 4 hours prior to the equity market close with myself and Carl. How are you?
I am doing just swell today, Scott. Yourself?
Doing well. And while I'm thinking about it, I hope everyone had a fantastic extended Labor Day weekend this past weekend. That was kind of nice. So I hope you did as well.
I did. I actually got to enjoy a little bit of calmness. My baby girl was very nice to me this weekend for the first time in what seems like months.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, what also is a result of Labor Day weekend is a short week for the equity market. So let's just dive right into that. Just an update on the major indices from last podcast to today. The S&P is almost to the tick where it started, or really where it closed this time last Thursday. So that's kind of interesting. So as flat as it can be, the Dow down 0.1%, so I'm going to call that flat. NASDAQ flat, Russell flat. So that's kind of interesting, but not really surprising for a short week like we've had this week. So that's been kind of nice. We'll talk about the impacts of that here in a second. Moving over to the Treasuries, 10-year yield now at, and I rounded it a little bit, but at 4.2, which is down a little bit. So, you know, we know the impacts, and we're going to go to Carl's corner as to what that can look like. Copper, one that we don't talk about very regularly, but now that it's a component in a lot of our portfolios, you know, it is something that we're going to pay a lot more attention to, up 3.3. And honestly, that is an indicator a lot of times of the breadth of the global markets. And so, you know, you would typically expect to see copper in an uptrend with interest rates, really prior to interest rates being in a downtrend. So that's encouraging, or I guess it's another confirmation that we should be anticipating a decelerating interest rate environment. So we'll get to that real quick, though. An interesting one, Carl, that we hardly ever talk about. Now, I used to talk about it. This is years ago. But if you look at the volatility index, this is kind of amazing, right? There's been times where volatility has felt probably felt higher than it actually was. I know that's the case for me, and I would think you would agree with that. But volatility is actually at an all-time low since this time in 2020. So COVID. And so over the last 5 years, now volatility is an all-time low. So give me your thoughts on that, and then we'll kick it over to Carl's corner.
Well, isn't that just absolutely fascinating? You know, we're living in some of the most volatile trading times since, you know, 2016 to 2018, and of course, COVID. But the first administration, the 2016-2018, when tariffs were first administered, you saw the VIX flying all over the place, and the same as you saw earlier this year, and now we're at all-time lows, which is absolutely fascinating, especially because we had a little bit of volatility this week, and you already stated that ends it flat. But with the institutional managers coming back, you know, into the office this week, you saw on Tuesday the massive movements during their rebalancing, right? And so that's very interesting that the VIX is down, especially when there's already volatility this week. But that goes to show that there is more stability in the market than we anticipated. And it also definitely shows that there's going to be some decelerating interest rates here coming shortly.
Yeah, that's right. And there have been it's not to diminish that there have been spikes in volatility. I just find, and we are at all time highs. So that part does make sense that we're in the equity markets. So that part does make sense that we're at all time lows. Volatility index, however, if you look at it, it's been a upper left to lower right ever since September of 2020. Of course, there's been some intermittent spikes along the way, but yeah, it's just a steady decline in volatility with a pretty steady incline. And to your point, Carl, about the institutional money managers coming back, taking over the books, and really doing a lot of rebalancing, that in a typical market, that is a leading driver as to why September and even October can be extremely volatile months, typically a little bit to the downside. However, this year could be very different from that for the reason that we're going to find out here in Carl's Corner.
Well, looking at the probabilities, we are now at 97% chance of a rate cut. And as we've discussed in the podcast before, once you get within that 20-day window of the Fed meeting, which we are in now because the Fed meeting is September 17th, that normally the highest probability has the best chance. And this is 97%. So this is close to the word guaranteed as you can use for a rate cut, barring anything crazy happening over the next 2 weeks. We do have some CPI, obviously PPI numbers. But the reason why the 20-day rule is so important is because that means they've already taken in all the last 2 months of data that's come in. It's easy to be able to project where the next PPI and CPI numbers are going to be. And therefore, they're already confident before they go into the meeting what is probably going to end up happening. And so, like I said, unless it's something completely jarring, like PPI is supposed to come out as 0.3 and it comes out as 2, something absolutely like that, we're looking at a rate cut, which in decelerating, especially active rate cut environments, which September 17th will be an active rate cut environment, the market tends to go to the upside. Well, September, October typically go to the downside, but as Scott has mentioned for years on this podcast, whenever you're in an interest rate sensitive environment, everything else is noise and you focus on the interest rates. And that's what we were doing. And that's why our portfolios are very, very interested in the interest rates themselves.
Yes, absolutely. That was done very much by intention. And, this is a story that we've seen many a time. I mean, it doesn't take dramatic cuts for those accelerating and decelerating environments to create movement across the major indices. And this will be no different. This will actually be a little more impactful than the 2018, 2019, actually. But I think at least. It's definitely something that we pay very much attention to. But to your point there, one of the spaces that we reallocated into that I'm very excited about is the small cap space. So they tend to utilize a lot of lending, and there's not a lot of lending going on based on the current rates. And that has to do with real estate as well, and financials and technology, all the areas that we have increased our allocations into. But I found this stat to be pretty staggering. So last Friday, 96% of the components of the Russell 2000 finished higher on the day, right? That's one day. What's the importance of that? Well, if you go back to 2010, a single day breadth reading that is in the 99th percentile, which this is, the balance of the year, and it really goes into January, but we'll say the balance of the year averaged a gain of 13.1%, 100% of the time. Now, that's just related to the Russell, and it has the most ground to make up. But, as you've heard me say, not very often, but as you've heard me say on the podcast, when I see 100% of the time, and probabilities are what they are, everything's 100% of the time at some point. Right? And then they start to come down. But that is, to me, a pretty eye-opening stat, and that tells me or gives me a lot of confidence, not only in our allocation into small caps, and really I think that'll bleed over into financials and real estate primarily. Tech's a little bit of a different animal, but it also gives me a lot of confidence that these probabilities related to interest rates themselves we're still on par. So I'm pretty excited about that part of it.
Absolutely. And, a lot of clients ask us how we find the investments that we find, what's our process? And just a 10,000 foot view, one of the first things we look at is what's the macroeconomics, right? And macroeconomic right now is interest rates are coming down. Okay, well, that, normally leads to everything coming up essentially, but certain sectors more. And then one of the next things we look at is the statistics. So now you have 100% statistic with the macroeconomic at play. And that was one of the driving factors into us reallocating a good portion into small caps as well as the tech side of it, because there's a lot of tech inside of the small cap stock as well. So there's a little 10,000 foot view of what we do when we make these portfolios. But we've got a question for the podcast, Scott. So why don't you go ahead and bring up that question now?
Yeah, we love when we get a question in the mailbag there. And this week's question, which is great, I don't think we've ever really covered it on here, was the difference between a spouse inheriting an IRA when it comes to RMDs versus a non-spouse. So in a lot of cases, that would be a child or grandchild inheriting an IRA. So a non-spousal inherited IRA. And what how that relates to required minimum distributions. So the question was, as a spouse, if I inherit that IRA, am I required to continue to take their RMDs if I am not of RMD age, if that makes sense? And the answer to that is no. It becomes your IRA. And you take RMDs based on your age, but even prior to their RMD age, because there is a difference here. Let's say your spouse was not of RMD age and you inherit that RMD. Well, you're still not subjected to that 10-year window of depleting that IRA like a non-spouse inherited spousal inherited IRA. Would have to adhere to. So, Carl, if you want to cover the non-spousal inherited IRA.
If you pass away, say you're 75 years old and your beneficiary is your grandchild, and your grandchild is 20 years old. All right, let's make it nice and easy example. The 20-year-old will now have RMDs, but he also will have to take it out within the 10-year period. So this came out in the Secure Act 2.0 in 2020 or 2021, where there is now a 10-year window for non-spouses, IRAs, right? Non-spousal beneficiaries have a 10-year window to take that money out, regardless of the RMDs or anything like that. So that is a new law that came into place just a few years ago. And so there was another, they did a whole new way before that that's grandfathered in. If someone passed away then, that's not the question. The question today is, does she have to take 10 years? The answer is no. It's basically your own. And you take RMDs when you turn RMD age, which as of this moment is 73. It will be moved to 75 in a few years, but as of today, it is 73 years of age.
Yeah. And I think that's a fantastic question because it applies to vast majority of the families, not only that we work with, but I believe to listen to this podcast as well. So yeah, I'm glad we got that question. If anybody can think of any other questions from a tax perspective, or really one of my passion projects here as of late, and it's sort of tied, well, they all tie in together. But even on the estate planning side, and kind of given some ideas on that side as well, which does tie in together with this sort of thing. So, yeah, any questions out there? We would love to cover them. And with that, that's all I've got. Carl, do you have anything else?
No, I do not. If you think anyone might enjoy our market commentary, feel free to forward them on over to you. We're also on the iHeartRadio app and the Podbean radio app.
Perfect. Thank you for that. And with that, we're going to go ahead and wish everyone a happy upcoming Friday and weekend. And we're going to go ahead and look forward to doing this again next week.